Hey there, if you enjoy this podcast, perhaps you'd like to sign up for my Core Texts in Philosophy class, delivered entirely online starting in mid-January. For more information, please go right now to partiallyexaminedlife.com/class.
This is Philosophy versus Improv, where two sages try to teach each other a thing or two, and maybe you, the audience, get something out of it as well. This is Mark Lintzenmeyer, peering into the mystical depths of philosophy.
And this is Bill Arnett, peering from the mystical depths, looking up. Is anyone seeing me? Is there anyone out there?
I can see.
Okay. Oh, there we go. Thank you.
And welcome to our guest. Please introduce yourself.
Simon Critchley. I teach philosophy at the New School for Social Research, which is where I'm speaking to you from.
And the author of Guardians, Book of the Day, and number one in the... What was the category that you just posted about on Facebook?
Occult magic.
Occult magic category. Mysticism.
Occult / magic? Occult and magic? Are they similar? Are they the same? Are we?
There's not occult magic. There's occult magic. And there's a...
just the regular mainstream magic that's different than the occult magic?
Not card tricks. No card tricks.
Oh, I see.
There's more magic with a CK.
No, sadly, no CK. No, it was more of a, it was that like New Age spirituality. I mean, God knows how Amazon do these. In the US, it's right up there in Renaissance literary criticism.
All right. Okay.
Well, perhaps you'll go mainstream here in that I recall being in Powell's Books, one of the largest bookstores in the country, and their philosophy section was maybe a shelf, one rack of shelves, but the metaphysics section, probably three times as big. So if your book can be confused and put in that section, maybe there are more people will stumble across it.
Yeah, hoodwink some people into buying it. I mean, I'm all in favor of that. It will attract exactly.
Let's get you a bigger net.
I don't care if they read it or not. If they buy it, that would be great.
So tell us a little about, as a philosopher, what attracted you to this topic. I was telling you when we talked briefly before how, before I even became a philosophy major, as an undergrad, I was kind of interested in mysticism, but I think that's because I thought it was going to yield knowledge. It was going to tell me about metaphysics. And then I read just far enough, maybe William James, I forget where I got this idea, but the idea that a mystical experience, as wonderful as it may be, pretty much just reaffirms whatever theology you already believe. So in other words, its philosophical content is zero, is something important just happened to you, but you can't put it into words, or you're going to put it in whatever words you already had on your lips beforehand. So tell us about what this is as philosophy to you, Simon.
That sounds like shots across the bow. Let me just say that right now, Mark.
It's true that I can't think of any mystics who have mystical experiences and then change their faith. They become Muslims or they become Hasidic Jews or whatever. No, it tends to be a confirmation of what you've already believed, but an intensification of experience. Mark, back then in those far distant days, I mean, which mystics were you reading? And
I mean, I remember a book by a guy named Anuradhadha Bharati, maybe? Modern Mysticism, Its Context and Pretext. I believe that was its name. That was sort of an overview. I was just getting into Eastern philosophy. So the Tao Te Ching, the Tao that cannot be spoken of is not the real Tao. And this idea, not that I was engaging in Buddhist practices, actual meditation practices, but it was, at least I was open to the idea that for someone who had that sort of discipline, there was something available to one. The only thing I remember from that book that I just mentioned is the idea that you argue against in your book, that this guy characterized the mystical experience as I am one with the universe. And actually, this really inspired me in terms of how the self can encompass various levels of circles of concern, that, you know, what counts as yourself is a little bit arbitrary. There are a lot of different philosophers that have variations on this idea, but the idea of actually feeling yourself as being one with the universe, and therefore the Christian mystics who, you know, their theology would not let them be one with God because that would be way too uppity, that there's something wrong with that. They weren't getting the full experience.
There are Christian mystics who, it's more in the Eastern tradition, in the Orthodox tradition, particularly with our Greek friends, there's this idea of theosis, deification, which is totally legitimate in Orthodox faith. You can become divine with the right luck and the right... So you made the journey east in a different way than Mark, it seems. My focus is Christianity because... to make what we think of as familiar and something that we think we know is actually intensely strange when you begin to puzzle it through, and how that's been picked up and dealt with over the centuries. I've done a few presentations and odds and ends in the last month or so, and you get the comparative religion question. You don't talk about Jewish mysticism. You don't talk about Sufis. You don't talk about Buddhism. And I don't. I say that at the end of the book. I do that because I'm incompetent. I'm interested. I've read to some extent, but I'm not going to just produce drivel on religious traditions that I don't really fully understand. Judaism, I've got much more of a handle on, but no. And I wanted to also just kind of emphasize that this thing that is Christianity is a very strange set of propositions that at its core is incarnation, God becoming human, becoming someone who is, an itinerant preacher just for a few years in occupied Palestine. This sounds familiar, doesn't it? Then is nailed to a tree and given the most appalling death, the most horrific death. I don't know if you've ever read descriptions of what happens in crucifixion, but it is really nasty. And it was a death that was intended to humiliate. And funnily enough, in the first centuries, perhaps the first millennium of Christianity, there are very few depictions of Christ on the cross. That happens much later. The early depictions of Christ are usually him with a young beardless man in a tunic with a magic stick, touching things and bringing the dead back to life or turning the water into wine. Mm-hmm. William James says one of the definitions of mysticism is union with the divine. There's nothing wrong with that, but there are mystics that don't fit that. And some of those are ones that really interest me, like Meister Eckhart and Marguerite Perret, where it's more about the soul losing its substance, self ebbing away, and God also. So the soul pouring out, and then also God pouring out. And what happens is what happens in the middle ground, mm-hmm. what Meister Eckhart, Godhead, which is neither God nor the soul. So the idea of union is that there is some sort of substance of the soul here, substance of God over there, and they sort of dock. That's not the whole picture.
I come from a more artistic background. I'm certainly familiar with Christianity and the Bible and how all that works. In the artistic world, especially the branch of the improv tree that birthed my current status, was started by a man named Del Close, who was a hippie freaking out the squares and very much into that whole artistic transcendental movement that happened then, and this idea that a group of people together can engage in these ritualistic processes and something will appear, a group mind, all those kinds of things can appear. And perhaps we might invoke spirits of inanimate objects and go through this ritualistic process that then creates the spirit. Some of it has some good functionality in creating some of the improv and art that happens. But how does the artistic spiritual experience compare to the religious one? Are they similar? Are they same? Is one a pale shadow of the other? Are you familiar at all, or can we speak to that at all?
In relation to comedy or relationship to theater?
Just art and theater and creation and poetry, and how that many times there is a mysticism associated with those things.
Yeah, I'm interested in the idea of the group.
Sure.
So my favorite theater group in New York since I've been, I knew about them before, was the Worcester Group.
Okay.
And come out of the tradition of living theatre, experimental theatre in the late 60s. And
oh, yeah.
Richard Schechner. And they were taking stuff from the great Polish director, Grotowski.
Okay, yep.
Grotowski's work is very ritualistic. It's very heavy. The Worcester Group, who are kind of one of the last vestiges of that, they're like a tribe, intensely focused, small group of people that have worked together for 30, 40 years.
Sure, sure.
I did a couple of talkbacks with them, one which went disastrously, another which went better. And they wouldn't really talk about what they were doing because it was almost like it was a superstition. But one got better, but they were saying that they were meant to do a collaboration with the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford-upon-Avon, a production of Troilus and Cressida by Shakespeare, one of the problem plays in Shakespeare, tragedy, comedy, history. It's all at once. And they were amazed that the Royal Shakespeare people were just hired for 6 weeks or 8 weeks on short-term contracts, and they were strangers to each other. They thought that the Royal Shakespeareans would be like, Shakespeare's troupe, and they were, his company were together for decades. And that communal experience, I think, is really important. Mysticism, particularly medieval stuff, the reasons why we have it is because it was popular.
Okay.
It found an audience right away and a big audience. and not an audience necessarily just amongst elites, but amongst ordinary people, like the Franciscans in central Italy, in Umbria, around there. And they were able to do something communally that was incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do believe in that. I believe in that in different fields as well. I think that I used to play in bands and none of them were successful and none of them were really that good. But I remember that feeling of being in a band, of sort of giving things over to other people and then hoping for something. Sometimes something did happen.
Yeah.
That's really special. And there's a ritualistic side to that. And the artistic and the mystical and the religious can be seen to blend with each other.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
So if there's not a single sort of metaphysic that is revealed, or we can't situate it that way, I mean, the way that you start the book is, here's a type of experience that a lot of people might not know is available and you'd probably enjoy. Is it a single? It sounds like it's a set of potential experiences. I mean, I've done a lot of music. One of the reasons I got into music, or, you know, I enjoyed church as a kid, was when the music would play. So they'd play Silent Night and you kind of get the tingles, which was not, I feel, one with the universe, but it was more than simply calming. You know, it seemed like there was something particular biologically going on. Does mysticism identify a particular set of biological reactions?
The closest I've really seen this is I spent 2 stays in Mount Athos in northern Greece, which is kind of the center of Orthodoxy. And it's fascinating because those monks at Mount Athos are under the direction of the Patriarch of Constantinople. But that's not really been the case since 1453. Constantinople. They kind of run the church.
In absentia, yeah. Yeah.
The Commonwealth of Monks. And they have significant political power and influence. And we've seen how that plays out in Putin in Russia, kind of reinventing Orthodoxy to suit his purposes. But with the Greeks, I went to Mount Athos, which is Holy Mountain, you know, where the Virgin Mary was alleged to have visited after Christ's death. She went on a little ship ride and wound up in Mount Athos and thought, this is lovely. So it's known as the Garden of Mary. And I was involved there for a number of days of just participating in services, which were in a foreign language. They're in Greek. I have some Greek, but not adequate Greek and not Byzantine Greek. And they were singing. It was just singing. And the monks would sing, and the churches were various. These were in monasteries, which held probably 80, 90 monks. Services began at 4 a.m. and more or less continued the whole day. So you're deprived of sleep and all this stuff is going on. And at that point, every sense is being activated. It's visual. You know, there's a lot of ceremony around lighting of candles, then the extinguishing of candles. Then, and when the candles are all lit on chandeliers, they get this stick out and they move the chandeliers and they create these kind of light shows. And then the singing will reach a kind of intensity. And, you know, you do that for long enough. I was there once for it was a vigil for the Virgin Mary during Lent. And it lasted, you know, I was there for 5-6 hours. And after a period of time, you are just being taken by that. It certainly didn't feel like being in any church that I'd been in before. Mm-hmm. And also, it was intensely physical in the sense that I was a guest. I was with a Greek friend of mine who was kind of an honored guest. And there was lots of physical touching, patting on the back and little words of encouragement. And they were talking amongst themselves all the time. And they had stacks and stacks of books, and they were keeping the whole thing going. It wasn't improv. I mean, they had texts, which they'd been using for centuries, but they were sort of making it up. And the idea of the vigil was, in a sense, to see how long they could keep on doing it for. And people would eventually drift away. The older monks would go to bed. Energetic younger ones would just keep going and keep at it. That was every visual sense, smell, lots and lots of incense, lots and lots of visual stimulation, or the absence of it. It was the church would be dark for long periods, but mainly everything was carried through song. And so that sense of song as being the carrier for the mystical, the religious, the aesthetic, that's one of the things I'm trying to argue for in the book. That there's artistic experiences, theatre. I'm very passionately in love with live theatre and have been for a long time, movies, all of that. But I think there's something about the experience of music, with a piece of music that you love and which animates you, which for me is unique. I don't get that in poetry or anything. It transports you. And it doesn't need to be live. You don't really need to see anything. I like to listen to music. alone or with my wife, and we just listened. We did this on Saturday night. We had a couple of martinis. We just began to listen to tunes that we loved, and then some tunes that she hadn't played for me before. And we're just sitting there having a really good time. And at that point, there is an aliveness in relation to music, which I think is, let's say, the strongest aesthetic experience.
Certainly. Yeah. No, I think that's all interesting stuff. And I've got a million and one questions, but I know we would love to do a little improv scene here. Right, Mark?
Yes. Can you have, has enough been said to center us to start doing the ritual so the feelings arise?
Oh, yes. And again, like I said, the world of improv is rich and there's many different styles and many different ways of doing it. And my pedigree is much more slice of life. The idea that we've all been improvising right now for the last 15, 20 minutes. We haven't planned what we've said, yet we've maintained who we are and some integrity with who we are. When we start improvising, we can be other people, yet still try to maintain that integrity and still try to maintain this idea of us creating something. And it's funny that we mentioned rituals.
Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including Romantasy, Autobiographies, True Crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Chris Gethard, and I'm very excited to tell you about Beautiful Anonymous, a podcast where I talk to random people on the phone. I tweet out a phone number, thousands of people try to call. I talk to one of them, they stay anonymous. I can't hang up. That's all the rules. I never know what's going to happen. We get serious ones. I've talked with meth dealers on their way to prison. I've talked to people who survived mass shootings. Crazy funny ones. I talked to a guy with a goose laugh. Somebody who dresses up as a pirate on the weekends. I never know what's going to happen. It's a great show. Subscribe today. Beautiful Anonymous.
Mark, have we ever done,
No.
The invocation, the improv invocation?
Unless I'm not remembering what you're talking about.
Okay, well, this is literally taught by that Del Close guy, who he's no longer with us, but he lived a very rich, drug-fueled life.
Yet he lives on in you.
Lives on, exactly. And we're going to follow a little thing here from the mundane to the holy, and we're going to start all of our sentences with the phrase, it is. Mm. And with it is, we will describe it physically. We will then move to you are, and we'll say what this thing does for us, what its purpose is. We will then move to thou art, in which we will now imbue its purposefulness with some holiness. We have some emotion around this thing. This thing is important to us. And finally, I am. The pentagon in the middle of the room, pentagram in the middle of the room has come to life, and rays have shot into our eyes, and now we are completely white, and the spirit of whatever object this is has taken us over. Now, again, as this may seem kind of a little silly or a little whatnot, the guy who did this, I think, you catch him on the right day, he believed it. So in that regard, this can be a holy experience. Now, the idea is that we're going to find out that even a boring old object may have a very important essence. So, for instance, let's start with a toaster.
Mm-hmm.
We'll make it a slice toaster rather than a toaster oven. So, again, I'll walk everybody through this. We're going to start with it is. It is silver.
It is electric.
It's electric, yep.
It is from Amazon.
Yep. It has two holes on top.
It is hard to get the toast out sometimes if you really toast it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It is potentially deadly.
It is difficult to use if you like well-burnt toast, as I do.
It has buttons and knobs on the side for adjusting it. It has little rubber feet to keep it from sliding around on the counter.
It is a quadruped.
It has integrity in its functioning.
It just does one thing to one thing. It is kind of one use.
It is. It is manifesting its excellence as a toaster by being a toaster. Being the toaster it is.
And we can move to you are. You are something I use almost every day.
Oh, is that a question?
No, I'm talking to the toaster. Now speaking to that. We have drawn a pentagram on the floor. The toaster is there. You are something I use every day.
Okay. You are something I use once a week.
You are something I do not have in my home anymore.
You get warm when you're on, quite warm, in fact, dangerously warm.
You are something that I bought a few years ago and which I would use more, but I fear carbohydrates.
You are last year's news.
You are old and full of crumbs.
You are at the point of becoming technologically obsolete.
You are a cherished childhood memory.
You are ubiquitous in most homes and haven't changed in decades.
You are the smell of the past.
You are technically part of the all that is all things taken as a set.
We will now move to thou art. Thou art the thing that welcomes me every morning.
Thou art the magic metal box in which bread is transformed into toasted bread. And the transformation between ordinary bread and toasted bread is one of the most extraordinary things I'm aware of.
Thou art a point of controversy in that some sects believe that when you transfer the bread to the toasted bread, you have literally transferred it to the toasted bread, whereas some groups think you've only figuratively transformed it to the toasted bread.
Thou art a substance, the transfigured substance, and I can then eat the toast, and in eating the toast, I'm eating you, thou, and I'm consuming you as though I were consuming God itself.
Thou art in every home. Thou art used in every restaurant. Thou art ubiquitous, yet very old.
Thou art the center of attention only when thou breakest down.
Thou art only at the center of attention when thou breakest down. And when thou breakest down, the category under which we apprehend you changeth from the practical to the theoretical. And at that point, thou art a possible object of philosophical concern.
Thou art something we overlook and give as a silly gift, yet thou art also in all of our houses. Thou art also something that greets us every morning with smells and warmth.
Thou art the welcoming presence. Thou art the comforting presence, the reminder of family breakfasts in the past, and the assurance that there will be at least some family breakfast in the future.
We can now change to I am. We are now speaking from the point of view of the toaster. The energy rays have hit the pentagram. The candles have flared and turned violent blue, and the electricity has shot around the room, and our eyes are now glowing white. I am. I am in every home.
I am quite underrated.
Mean it, Mark. You got to mean it.
I am what I am. And my being will persist and dominate and outlive all of you, my users.
I am able to transform bread into toast, yet you think nothing of that.
I am capable of the transformation of substance from one form to another. You are just a dying animal.
I am really the center of the universe, taken from my point of view.
I am the toaster of toast.
I have one simple job, yet you all need me for that job.
I am the ender of untoasted bread worlds. I am the destroyer of non-heated existence.
I am the alpha and omega of toasted bread.
And your alpha and omega, if you throw me in a bathtub.
That's right.
While plugged in. We did it, everybody. We did it. We have invoked the spirit of toaster. And look at you tell me the crazy places we got to.
It's true. That's true.
This maybe demonstrates my inability to fully enter into mystical experience, because I seem to want to comment about the activity.
Rather than give yourself over to the activity.
Self-consciousness is not compatible with full immersion.
Yeah, I take a pretty negative view of self-consciousness. We have it, but I think it's overrated.
Yeah, so is the metaphysical thing, right? It might not be becoming one with the universe or something, but is a shedding of the ordinary existential attitude, the ordinary way of relating to the self. So whether it's a complete loss of sense of self, or at least vertigo, some sort of out of body, some sort of change from the usual. I mean, is that at least a way of characterizing the set of experiences? It's not merely, I'm still me, but I'm sitting in front of the wonderment and I'm appreciating it. that doesn't seem like that would be the cognitive content of any mystical experience.
I don't know. I think we can get a long way with the toaster. The interesting thing about, say, medieval devotional practice was full of things, icons, Christ's foreskin, Christ's tooth. I mean, there are probably four foreskins of Christ in. He had a very large foreskin.
They shared it, yeah. And it's all, they've got the paperwork too, I'm certain.
They have it. It's all legit.
Authenticated, yeah.
Yeah. Medieval devotion is very haptic and it's very thing-based. And then this all goes kind of haywire after the Reformation. Luther kind of sets things going, and then, you know, he's locked up safely in a castle translating the New Testament. But the Reformation has really caught fire, and then there begins to be these cycles of iconoclasm where locals are going into churches and smashing everything up. And then there is somewhat appalled by that. So do we need these objects? Luther says, don't destroy them. They're matters of indifference, he says. Adiaphora is the word he uses. Things of indifference. And I guess I am interested in the thingly dimension of religion, which is something that the Reformed churches, Protestant Reformed churches, are very down on. All that there is scripture and you and the Bible, and then that's the closest you're going to get. So all of that stuff fades away. To some extent, it survives in Catholicism a little bit more strongly, but even there, it's a pretty Protestant Reformed or counter-Reformation Catholicism. I'm much more interested in these in the experience of a cosmos, you know, which is full of stuff and things which are continually tipping over into animation. You know, and we do that with things all the time. With the toaster, which takes us back to this. Mm-hmm. Toaster is this inert piece of metal or whatever it is that does this one thing excellently, but it can be part of a world, part of a kind of mini cosmos.
I promise Toaster will come back. And when we do another little improv scene, Toaster will make another appearance, Mark. Don't worry.
Thank goodness.
In a proper improv scene, I promise. A short question and then maybe a longer question. Are you aware of any societies that have existed that did not have a spiritual element to them? No. Okay. No. So it's safe to say that we could perhaps posit that humanity somewhere within our DNA is some acceptance of or room for spiritualism. Is that what gets exploited by, say, cults? Or is that the same? Is it the same mechanism that is exploited by cults? I said the same thing twice.
Religions that people don't like or are rather small.
Or religions that, not even religions, self-help cults, things that are ultimately destructive or ultimately take money or leave people hollow or hurt others. I realize that it's easy to paint any small religion as a cult or something, but there are certainly ones that are more destructive or more malicious, let's say, even if the leaders don't believe in them. Those have certainly existed. Is it the same spot on the body that's being scratched?
Well, yeah, let me add to that. Right. If the mystical experience is a set of some goods, that there's no particular theology or whatever you need to get to that, then even a cult that we just take a bunch of acid or whatever the thing, and then I take your wallets. It seems like if it was actually delivering its promised goods, obviously it could do other bad things. But there's no reason, if we want to say one of the chief goods of religion is to get you to reevaluate your relationship with the universe, to feel this in a very vivid way, I could see that, yes, it would not be a matter of which religions are politically sanctioned or something, but like, can it actually deliver the goods? So that there really would be no, only someone inside the cult, inside the group, would be able to say, and I guess if this was a very non-specific feeling, then one could say, you know, just inspiring devotion toward dear leader. I feel so much joy when I gaze upon you, dear leader, and, you know, making everybody your slaves. Maybe even, like, I think that was part of it. Could even that count as mystical experience in the positive sense, even though clearly it is being abused?
I don't know. I don't really know. I think taking your wallets could actually be a good thing in the sense of...
Yes.
Sure. No earthly distractions.
What's going on, with the Franciscans in the 12th century and afterwards, and then with a group called the Heresy of the Free Spirit. And this also reappeared later on, say, during the English civil war slash revolution, the abolition of private property and individually held wealth. That was a precondition for a religious community, and goods were held in common and nobody owned anything. I think that would be a great experiment to continue with. And also, the first thing you were saying, Bill, that the, you know, more radical thought, it's a speculation, obviously, but for as long as there have been human beings, there has been some religion. And then within that religious practice as a social fact, there's usually a mystical tendency within it. There's someone who is organizing or shaping or leading the group to do certain things. So what we poorly call shamanism. But and that was clearly case if you look at, say, what was happening in, say, Neolithic societies, as far as we know. And also, being the shaman was a kind of terrible fate because the training was so austere and they had fairly awful lives. They weren't exactly absolute dictators.
Yeah.
And they go through these intense trials. But then the more interesting thought is, well, is this just true of Homo sapiens?
Yeah.
Is it just Homo sapiens have these practices? And I think the evidence now from, you know, Neanderthal finds, and then the, you know, the way DNA research has been changing the nature of archaeology, the Denisovans, you know, that we know about this other strand of hominids that were there, traces were found in Siberian caves, but they're all over the place. And it would appear that, say, the Neanderthals had ritual practices. And so then why not other hominids? Is it something that's just particular to all hominids? I think it's a desire, to some extent, for stylization, that human beings are not literal creatures. We want things symbolized, stylized, animated. You know, I think about those cave paintings in Lascaux, where you're getting some situation where the creatures described, which we think of in realistic terms, that, well, these were the creatures that they saw wandering the plain. And that's not the case. They're kind of half-imagined creatures some of the time. They were, you know, made almost impossible to see inside these caves. They could only be seen with flickering lamps, and to give a kind of almost like a, you know, a movie effect.
Yeah.
There's a lot more of it out there. And also, I think the possibility to exploit the religiosity that human beings all seem to possess, you can't legislate for that. When you can, the American experiment in many ways is to, you know, you can be a Jew, a Muslim, or a Buddhist, as long as you're a Protestant Jew, a Protestant Muslim, and a Protestant Buddhist, and we respect the distinction between the private and the public. You're free to practice your religion as long as you keep it out of the public realm, which is then this whole debate about whether the United States is a Christian country or not. And of course, it's not. It's a deistic country. There's a God, but it's a God that kind of floats out there.
Yes.
The Constitution, but it doesn't interfere with the Constitution.
Clock-winding God.
Yeah, it's a clock-winding God that sets the universe in motion, whereas Christianity is an interventionist God who comes down into the temple and tears shit up and does take your wallet. The extraordinary thing about the American experiment with religion, or experiments with religion, is that you can have this kind of clockwork God, constitution, you know, a republic modeled more or less on some version of Rome, gods on the dollar bill, blah, blah, blah. And then on the surface, on the ground, you've got this, you know, intense, wild religious activity going on.
You don't have to tell us about it. We're having to live through all that. And
and the Shakers were amazing. They also didn't believe in private property. They believed in the complete equality of men and women. And they practiced chastity.
Yeah.
Died out.
And we're out of them. We're out of Shakers. We're out
of Shakers. The last ones remain. Another fascinating story for me is the Mormons. I've always been fascinated with the Mormons. I mean, and there, I remember being at teaching it for a semester at Notre Dame, and this very, very good philosopher just said to me, I was talking about Mormonism in something. He said, oh, well, that's just a cult. Okay. You don't like it. Okay. I get that.
Well, are you familiar with the, I don't know if Mark knows about this, the FBI, the federal police, and the CIA love recruiting Mormons because they're generally less corruptible. They're generally not drinking. They generally love their family and their wives, and they generally, they're harder to corrupt. The foreign spies can't touch them because they're more pious than the average person. I thought that was interesting. All the classic sex, they're not going to get in trouble with money. They're not going to, they can't be bought off.
when Mitt Romney was running for president, I wrote an essay for the New York Times called Why I Love Mormonism. Got me into a lot of trouble. The strange thing there is that Joseph Smith was, he was someone that believed that he was divine and other people could be divine. Certainly other men could be divine. So it's an idea of God, which is corporeal, plural, and finite, which is really strange. And I did a Brigham Young University years ago. After that thing came out, I went out there maybe 2014, and we had a private session. I'd asked for it, and of course there were Mormons, they organized it. There were 20, 30 Mormon academics, and we debated the meaning of Mormonism to someone who was a curious outsider. And it was absolutely fascinating. There's a whole Mormon feminist line of thought, and they get called a cult.
We should probably do one more improv scene, right, Mark?
Sure, go ahead.
To get you up to speed here, Simon, we're just going to pretend to be other people.
Okay.
That's it. I'll get this thing started, and we can then, we've already had debates, Mark and I have, and other guests about what does it mean to be someone else? What is it that you, what is different about you if you are someone else? But I'll get a situation going, and we'll just live inside that situation. You all call for IT support. I'm here to help out if you need any IT problems.
It seems like the computer, its essence has been displaced. It's somehow, I mean, it won't turn on.
Okay. Have you turned it off and turned it back on?
Yes. I mean, sometimes it does technically turn on, but it does not show anything on the screen. It seems like the essence of the computer is to show the things on the screen. Uh-huh. When it does not show the things on the screen, I feel like it is failing in its telos.
In its arete.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that stuff. I'm just the IT. That's all I do is IT. So have you, Simon, have you your computer working, Simon? Have you?
I have two computers working. I'm Mr. Tech here. I've got you on one screen and I've got some nonsense on the other screen.
Okay. Have you tried turning it off and back on again?
Turn it on? Okay, I could turn it on and turn it off.
It seems like on your screen is what's supposed to be showing on my screen. The little flashing thing when you turn it on, that's supposed to be on my screen, and yet I see it on your screen. Has there been a transmigration? Is that a computer thing?
Everybody, let's just, IT's here to fix the problems. Let's all just start by turning off our machines and turning them back on again. Count to 10, turn it off, count to 10, turn them back on. All right, so let's just all do that. Thank you.
Okay. Two, X, three, eight, four.
Internal capacitance. There's internal capacitance that drains. 9, 10. Okay, everybody turn your machines back on. All right. They should be working. They should be.
The chime that indicates the functioning did not play. It is a ritualistic chime. It says, I'm awake. I'm with you. I'm at your disposal. And
did you turn it all the way off? Did you turn it off? I asked you.
Removed from the power source. Reattached to the power source, the power flows, but yet the sound is absent.
All right, let's try this again. Let's just try this again. Everywhere and try this again. In fact, I turn it off at the power strip. How about that? Let's just, everyone turn off your computer at the power strip. We'll count to 10. We'll turn it back on. Okay?
Okay.
This should do it. I don't understand either. Okay? This should do it. 8, 9, 10. Okay, everybody, turn it back on at the power strip.
When the power strip is interfered with, then the lava lamp also shuts down, and that's very problematic.
That's right. The lights have just gone out. I'm facing St. Patrick's Cathedral, and all the lights have just gone out.
Is that nice? It's at St. Patrick's Cathedral?
It's very dark. I can't even see it now. I think we've caused a blackout in St. Patrick's Cathedral.
Is the darkness of a beautiful structure like St. Patrick's Cathedral superior to the darkness and the absence of merely a toaster, say.
Are y'all done with me? Am I still here for a reason? Can I leave?
You've begun something, and we must complete the ritual. You've been summoned. You attempted to help, like the Good Samaritan, but yet I feel like your job is not done here, that you have more to teach us.
I have a question.
Yeah, question.
Do you think that we have a free relationship to computers, or that we live in servitude to them?
This would be good to know.
Maybe when you turn it off, you're free, but when you turn it back on, you're not. I mean, it can't turn itself on. you got to do it. You can do a warm, but you can do a warm, you can do a software reboot. But with something like this, if it's not loading, you need to turn it off all the way at the source and turn it back on.
Turn it off, we're free.
So the ritualistic turning on and turning off represents I can free myself, but yet then I embrace my chains.
You know, maybe, I'm not sure what project you're working on. I don't know what the Nate, if you just checking emails, you know, maybe, but if it's like a work thing, probably a work thing. That's why they called me, but probably a work thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's, yes. Yeah. Okay.
They're looking at the lava lamp. They're looking out the window at the St. Patrick's Cathedral.
Yeah.
All these things are involved. Really, they're all one.
I mean, I guess you could pull the shades and then open the shades again if you don't want to look at the church. That's available as well.
I do that in the summer, but now it's really dark over there, and Fifth Avenue is also getting really dark. So it's, who knows what's happening out there in the city.
I've got some other people to attend to. I've got to go, be around the office helping people with their machines. So if we're cool here, okay. Are we cool?
I feel like that we should take advantage of the time. You've made the pilgrimage to come here. You've answered a very important question about servitude. Can you tell us ultimately what is the function? What does the IT mean to you, to your life project?
The computers need to work. They need to be on. And I go to people for whom their computer is not on and help it be on. I don't.
That's so admirable. He unreflectively sinks into his work. He lets himself be enveloped by the experience of helping people with the onness and the offness.
True.
Cool. Okay.
Are there other computers that you might bring us to enhance the decor in here?
If your computer is not working, we tried turning it off and back on. If it's still not working, you can fill out a service slip and we can maybe get you a new one. You know, it could be a couple days. We may have a loaner down at the office, but we can, if you need another computer, we can provide that. But you need to fill out a service slip. Yeah.
She's like Cable Guy, isn't it? That movie, Cable Guy, said with her.
I feel perhaps the lava lamp might be sufficient for one's needs. Perhaps a flat screen really doesn't add that much. That maybe having a circumstance that robs one of this modern technology just makes you appreciate the lava lamp that much more.
So like a three-dimensional lava lamp computer.
The lava lamp can serve many of the functions that the computer served, perhaps.
Your manager is cool with that. That's, what am I to say?
So please take the computer with you.
Sure. I'll send you an email with a service.
I will look for the lava lamp for that email. That's what I have. I hope it will work.
Cool. We'll make sure your manager is also informed in case that's a thing. Okay. Well, we're all good here. Otherwise-ish.
All right.
We did it. What was I, y'all?
I don't know.
You are a very single-minded.
I'm ubiquitous. I help other people. Every business has an IT guy, but I only do one thing. Just turn your computer on and off.
Ah, the brave, helpful little toaster.
I'm the toaster. I'm the toaster.
You told the answer minutes ago, but we had to remember that and did not. I'm still talking in that voice, am I not? It's hard to break character.
The idea is, and how this thing gets used a lot in the improv world, is this idea of, can we take a boring old suggestion like toaster, but find a behavior, a personality, a person, a character inside of it? And that was the work just then. And going through that little ritual of turning something boring into finding some meaningful humanness in it is that process.
Okay.
My IT guy, who only had one use, just like a toaster, yet is ubiquitous, like the IT department, I thought was a pretty good personification of that. Without ever mentioning toaster.
Well, you just mentioned toaster.
Well, I did just now, but I mean, my character didn't mention toaster. Within the scene, I was able to be a toaster without being a toaster. The essence of toaster.
I was thinking toaster when you were doing the IT guy, actually.
All right. Okay. There we go. We're having a moment here. We're communicating without words.
Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including Romantasy, Autobiographies, True Crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
So comparably, can one have the mystical experience without calling it the mystical experience? I know one of your beefs in this book is the way that discussion of mysticism, besides just, you know, dismissal of everything mystical and philosophy, just using the term to refer to anything that doesn't make sense, is lumping everything under this religious experience. And this discussion, we've sort of been ranging hither and yon, talking about different religious practices, rituals, and things, whereas it's not just, maybe it was with the dawn of psychedelics or something like that, where, oh, that's the paradigm case. I'm whatever this is. And then religions did something similar. But of course, the many centuries of religious tradition. Yeah, give us your stump speech before we go about why lumping this all into merely religious experience is reductive and misses a lot of the good stuff you're writing about in the book.
It reduces religion to experience that one either has or one does not have. And then it reduces the complex life of something like religion to the question of, well, do you believe or do you not believe in the existence of God? And we imagine that's it. Have you experienced this or have you not? And that reduces religion to a kind of toaster, a toaster in your...
Excellent synthesis.
You either have it or you don't have it. I think the least you have to do is to understand the full range of religious life. Oh, the other thing is that for most of the mystics, the experiences they had, the extreme experiences they had, were transient. They lasted a number of hours. Julian of Norwich, it's about 12 hours that she's having her showings. And then she spends 30 years trying to figure it out. And in doing that, she rewrites Christianity. It's amazing. So it's not that, you know, we tend to reduce mysticism to experiences, and then it becomes a question of whether religious experience can be synthesized in terms of, you know, people microdosing on this, that, and the other. What that ignores is the fact that this is also conceptual. Mm-hmm. It's a set of practices in which one was involved: meditation, prayer, contemplation, composition, but most importantly, reading. That what people in religious communities did was they read. And the idea of prayerful reading and the kind of attention that that requires is the key thing. So I think the experiential side of it is overrated. The psychedelics issue, I remember some years ago, I wrote this piece on the Eleusinian Mysteries on, and I was in Greece and writing these pieces about Athens. And, you know, there you've got, well, what was going on in the Mysteries is explained by Terence McKenna in terms of these people were all tripping. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But that's to underestimate the thing you were saying at the beginning, Bill, about what's possible in a communal experience with a group. You don't need that to be just a drug experience. That could be something you have just through participation in a group. So I think it's overrated. And the fascination with drug experiences, it's fine, but it's also, I find it a tiny bit sad, you know, that when I was growing up, people at least had the dignity of die of drug overdoses.
Yeah, yeah. In for a penny, in for a pound. You're going to go all the way. You get about
90 to 27 and then off you went. This whole, you know, manicured boutique version of drug lifestyle and perfection of the self. It's all a bit too private and a bit too...
Selfish? Selfish?
Yeah, it's selfish. It's selfish. I mean, I talk about music at the end of the book, and, you know, there was a great producer in Germany called Konrad Planck, Connie Planck, who worked with Neu, and he ended up working with, I won't say imbeciles like U2, but he ended up working with U2 and a whole number of bands. But certainly in the 70s and into the 80s, he would always give the band small amounts of LSD. Because he wanted to relax them. Not them to, for them to experience some other state, but in order for them to be in the studio and just to relax, to be there with each other and to improvise.
Sure, 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 sure.
They knew the tunes. They'd rehearsed them for weeks, and this was their precious studio time. But, you know, when you get studio time, or you used to get studio time, you get very nervous because you knew, you know, everything was on the clock. So Connie Planck would just relax them with some LSD, and then sometimes great things happened. Sometimes they didn't.
Yeah. I was at a jazz show at the Green Mill, a famous bar here, jazz club here in Chicago, and it's very small, intimate space, and friend of a friend of a friend kind of a thing had a regular gig, and she plays the piano and a little trio, and they had a guest vibraphonist sitting in with them. And, you know, maybe they had played some before, but not much at all. And they probably played 10, 12 songs over the course of the night. But there were, and, you know, again, this is very much jazz kind of a thing. So every song had solos in it, and people took turns with their solos. And there was one song in particular that, for whatever reason, the solo really hit. And all the players knew it, and you could tell by watching them that they found a groove. They found something, this unnameable thing. And when it was over, everyone clapped far more than we clapped for all the other songs that were just as improvised. And the players all shook hands and pat each other on the back, like, yeah, that was really good. And it's like, how? Well, you know, it's like from the objective sense, I couldn't tell you why everybody in the room, performers and observers, were like, that was better than everything else was.
Yeah.
That assembly of notes that were never written down was better and cooler and more interesting than everything else was. But it was. And that could be a mystical experience. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Good. Well, this has been great.
Simon, thanks again for joining us in one of many, many attempts now to achieve in a group setting with the audience that ecstasy, that union, that oneness that will mark the apex of this podcast. Thanks for being here for one of those attempts.
Thank you for, you know, introducing me to Toaster World.
You got it.
All right. Everybody should go check out Mysticism, Simon Critchley. We barely scratched the surface. There's a lot of good stuff in there. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, should we do a little post-game? We haven't done post-game in a long time.
I know. We haven't had a post-game in a while. We certainly can, Mark.
We've now had, is it three? I don't know if it's our last three philosophy guests, but three of our recent philosophy guests all had a book.
Yes.
And I think they went different ways, interestingly different ways. Part of why this went different was because you took such a different approach to the improv, which I thought was interesting, that it really set a mood doing that first exercise.
I was inspired, Mark.
Yeah.
It was about mysticism. And I can't deny that there's mysticism in the arts.
I almost feel, I mean, maybe this is part of mystical contemplation. It's not always, but is sometimes apophantic. Can't be put into words. It is maybe negative theology, right? You can only say what God is not, because God is so awesome.
Okay.
So maybe one of the ways that, you know, you get to a mystical, or, you know, that you focus yourself, is just by sort of paring things down. And he's not this, and he's not this, and not this. And now I will contemplate the inexpressible remainder that is left. Yeah. Is that what we're doing?
I can see that. Yeah.
I like the idea of making these authors jump through these hoops. And I think they've been very, for the most part, very happy to do it. I was a little unclear this in the second one, when he was talking about the computer that was actually next to him in the room, if it was another one of those situations where the guest maybe doesn't know that we're in his. So I wasn't clear how he and I were in the room together, for instance.
Yeah.
Are you doing a Zoom consultation with both of us? I don't think that was part of the setup, but it wasn't.
I think we're just going to sweep that under the rug and pretend like it didn't happen. Right. Not draw attention to it.
I withdraw my comment.
No, it's a fair comment. It's a fair comment. But I have definitely been in scenes, improv scenes live, that will have a confusing element. It's like, well, let's just not go there anymore. Let's just not bring up anything that would cause that to be a problem.
So did you feel like you from that discussion, I mean, it was mostly, again, what mystical experience maybe could be, but like, it seemed very inclusive. Let's put it that way. Like anything that involves the religious life, which I don't even think, you know, if taking acid and having a certain kind of experience counts, it's not clear to me that it's religious, right? That, like,
sure.
That's sort of the point of people who are into psychedelics, of like, oh, this is a thing the brain can do. I don't want to believe in a bunch of garbage, but I do want to experience this awesome thing. So please load me up. Get me some of that good tunes or the good hashish. I don't know what you used.
Yeah, I do agree that some people do throw the word cult around as a pejorative. But come on now, there's, you know, Nexium and even some of these self-help cults. I think they're going after the same thing. When you talked about how that Greek ceremony where it's you're up all day, you're tired, you're hungry. It's like, that's actually like a brainwashing technique.
Well, yeah, and that seems like right, what he was like, describing with the the music festival in the church.
Yeah.
Is like, as the hours go on, yes, your normal resistance to immersing yourself is going to be, yeah, we could take your money. That would be good for your poverty. We could starve you. You know, suffering could be a way into.
Yes.
So we could justify any sort, as long as it's done for religious purposes and not just to be cruel or out of negligence.
We could also enrich you and give you a wonderful experience and make sure you're well fed and taken care of afterwards. But yes, was happy that he said that all cultures have some form of spirituality, which means it must be some biological process if it's not cultural, and in which case, as a biological process, it could certainly be manipulated. Just like pictures of fluffy kittens make everybody ooh and ah and whatnot. It's hitting, it's scratching something inside of us in the same way that everybody knows about cults. They still happen. Everybody knows about con men and used car salesmen. They still happen.
Sure.
So clearly there is a button on us that's getting pushed when we get involved with these things. So, you know, knowledge of them does not defend us from getting suckered by things. It's unfortunate.
For tomorrow evening, I'm with Partially Examined Life talking about a guy named Ludwig Feuerbach.
Never heard of him.
That name probably doesn't mean. He was a big influence on Karl Marx in his early years. So that's why.
Yeah, yeah.
And for someone, Karl Marx's big thing moving from Hegel is, I want to just talk about material stuff. You're talking about Hegel. You're talking about the evolution of the universe and God coming to know himself. And that's all very weird. I want to talk about the similar, like, directionful course of history, but it is about, you know, society becoming better and better, not about
enrichment, personal enrichment or fulfillment.
Well, Hegel's thing was weird. Anyway, Feuerbach was sort of in between, but he strangely, for somebody that, you know, the ultimate goal of this is to get more materialistic, he wrote a lot about religion, and it was sort of a backhanded dismissal of religion in that he said, you know, really any culture, what they say is God is just what they think of themselves, is like their,
sure,
their best qualities. So, and some of it is a little obnoxious that, you know, the Jewish religion originally, like, God thinks we're special. We're, you know, he has a deal just with us, that is a certain kind of self-conception,
mm-hmm,
that we're the ones who deserve this personal God. And this God is jealous and you can only serve him, as opposed to then a super touchy-feely Christian God, as Simon was describing, that's all just love. And even the idea of miracle is basically saying, I want the world to, even though it doesn't seem to obey my every wish, I want, it really can. It really does. So in other words, it's unabashed subjectivity. It's unabashed, you know, embracing a dream world. And he kind of says, like, this is what religion is anthropologically. And if it's serving that function, maybe it's just fine. Right. So
yeah,
if it's helping a culture cope with whatever is going on with them right now, you know, and reflecting their self-conception. And it's only actually when philosophers come in and try to fix the religion and make it make more sense that they're like, oh, the miracles didn't really happen, or they're all in the past, or we have to interpret symbolically the things in the Bible, not literally. According to Feuerbach, those guys are actually losing the point.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be this kind of childlike thing, this childlike innocent expression of a culture, and you're trying to rationalize it, and that doesn't make it, you know, it doesn't make it better. You're getting rid of what was an authentic emotional connection with this thing. And so, you know, the philosophers are actually making it into atheism. So atheism is sort of the natural, yeah, we're actually going to, you know, evolve through trying to make it respectable. We're actually just rejecting the whole thing, and we end up, you know, so that's why you might say God is dead at the end of it. Nietzsche was kind of the same time as Feuerbach.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I've certainly encountered some atheists who certainly behave as though they're in a cult.
Sure. Yeah. So this is just, it's the weirdest kind of atheist that I've ever read.
Fair enough.
That is trying to take this stuff very seriously in a way, and psychologically.
Almost like it's a religion.
I mean, yes, there is the function for a religious feeling. I think that was, yes, again, Simon saying that this happens in all cultures, and
yes,
it would be very strange if something, whether you want to say that that is, well, in all primitive cultures, in all pre-scientific, pre-enlightened cultures.
Well, we're not different. We're no different. And, I think we're no different, and to deny people their spirituality, I think, is kind of cruel. But we do need to be careful with that thing that we all are.
Well, so does that mean that you try to convert your spirituality, you try to sublimate it into something that is, doesn't make you believe stupid stuff, but you can just be spiritual, you feel spiritual, but it doesn't entail any particular beliefs? Or say, no, I'm going to actually go with the traditional thing, and I'm going to believe 10 ridiculous things before breakfast, because that is actually what religion is. And I can even do this socially, even though we realize that there is something weird about this and it doesn't really fit with the modern world. We're actually going to embrace it in its primitiveness because we understand that that is serving a psychological benefit, that when I am in the plane that's crashing, I'm going to pray. And maybe it makes sense from that point of view to pray. There's always something going on. There's always something you could feel more peaceful about. And so why not just engage in the ritual? And
we haven't been right yet. Mm-hmm. Every generation has figured out how the previous generation screwed something up, be it math or science or anything. So for sometimes this whole cult of like, well, we're logical and logic is completely perfect. It's objectively correct. And sometimes you get that sometimes, and that whole kind of holier than thou kind of attitude. Well, now we've figured it out, and it's kind of gross. And like, come on, you will be proven wrong. You will be proven wrong. Maybe we should light up a little bit and let people be, as long as not hurting other people. Yeah.
Oh, so next time we're covering an improver that has a book, right?
Yeah.
Somebody that reached out to us.
Yes.
So we'll see how that compares. I feel like maybe we did one or two of those before.
Indeed. Indeed.
And they were able to do the thing. Plus they wrote a book. I don't know. Maybe it's a more natural fit.
We shall find out.
All right. Well, thanks as always for hanging and you're spreading your wisdom. I learned a lot from you today, Bill.
I learned a lot from you today, Mark.
And scene.
Scene. I should sell my soul. Bankrupt. 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 Bankrupt.